listeners, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and harky, the Ides of March were just upon us. But fear not, gentle audience, we come not to bury the bard, but to praise him. It's time for the Book Report to salute old Will himself. Yes, the plays are the things, but books on his life, the controversies, Tudor history, and so much more are what's in store today. As you like it, and I hope you will, we'll turn now to page one of the Book Report.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MagicBuzz.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
To get us started, let's listen to scenes from Shakespeare from the Bard's finest plays, read by a stellar cast. The collection includes scenes from Julius Caesar, yes, he of Ides of March fame, The Merchant of Venice, Twelfth Night, Romeo and Juliet, Richard III, Macbeth, King Lear, Hamlet, and Othello, performed by a distinguished company of actors, including Sir John Gielgud, Sir Michael Redgrave, Paul Scofield, Albert Finney, Claire Bloom, and Vanessa Redgrave. It's a wide-ranging introduction to the work of the world's greatest playwright.
By my soul, I swear, there is no power in the tongue of man to alter me. I stay here on my bond.
Most heartily, I do beseech the court to give the judgment.
Why then, thus it is. You must prepare your bosom for his knife.
Oh, noble judge. Oh, excellent young man.
For the intent and purpose of the law hath full relation to the penalty which here appeareth due upon the bond.
'Tis very true. Oh, wise and upright judge. How much more elder art thou than thy looks?
Therefore, lay bare your bosom.
Aye, his breast. So says the bond, doth it not, noble judge? Nearest his heart. Those are the very words.
It is so. Are there balance here to weigh the flesh?
I have them ready.
Have by some surgeon, Shylock, on your charge, to stop his wounds, lest he do bleed to death.
Is it so nominated in the bond?
It is not so expressed. But what of that? 'Twere good you do so much for charity.
I cannot find it. 'Tis not in the bond.
You, merchant, have you anything to say?
But little. I am armed and well prepared. Give me your hand, Bassanio. Fare you well. Grieve not that I am fallen to this for you. For herein fortune shows herself more kind than is her custom. It is still her use to let the wretched man outlive his wealth, to view with hollow eye and wrinkled brow an age of poverty, from which lingering penance of such misery doth she cut me off. Commend me to your honorable wife. Tell her the process of Antonio's end. Say how I loved you. Speak me fair in death. And when the tale is told, bid her be judge whether Bassanio had not once a love. Repent but you that you shall lose your friend, and he repents not that he pays your debt. For if the Jew do cut but deep enough, I'll pay it instantly with all my heart.
Antonio, I married to a wife which is as dear to me as life itself. But life itself, my wife, and all the world are not with me esteemed above thy life. I would lose all. I sacrifice them all here to this devil to deliver you.
Your wife would give you little thanks for that, and she will buy to hear you make the offer.
I have a wife whom I protest I love. I would she were in heaven, so she could entreat some power to change this currish Jew.
'Tis well you offer it behind her back. The wish would make else an unquiet house.
Oh, these be the Christian husbands. I have a daughter. Would any of the stock of Barabbas have been her husband rather than a Christian?
We trifle time. I pray thee, pursue sentence.
A pound of that same merchant's flesh is thine. The court awards it, and the law doth give it.
Most rightful judge.
And you must cut this flesh from off his breast. The law allows it, and the court awards it.
Most learned judge,
a sentence! Come!
Prepare.
Tarry a little. There is something else. This bond doth give thee here no jot of blood. The words expressly are a pound of flesh. Take then thy bond, take thou thy pound of flesh, but in the cutting it, if thou dost shed one drop of Christian blood, thy lands and goods are, by the laws of Venice, confiscate unto the state of Venice.
Oh, upright judge, mark, Jew, oh, learned judge.
Is that the law?
Thyself shalt see the act, for as thou urgest justice, be assured, thou shalt have justice more than thou desirest.
Oh, learned judge, mark, Jew, a learned judge.
I take this offer then. Pay the bond thrice and let the Christian go.
That was Scenes from Shakespeare. Shakespeare, the biography, has been called a magnificent feat of recreating 16th century London and Stratford. Best-selling biographer and novelist Peter Ackroyd, who has also explored the lives of Chaucer, Dickens, and T.S. Eliot, brings Shakespeare to life in the manner of a contemporary rather than a biographer. Ackroyd positions the playwright in the context of his world, exploring everything from his small town of Stratford to the London of the day. Writing as though we are observing Shakespeare and his circle of friends, patrons, managers, and fellow actors and writers, Ackroyd brings you a portrait of Shakespeare's genius from within. Simon Vance narrates.
John Shakespeare and his newborn son would have been accompanied by the godparents, who were otherwise known as Godsips or Gossips. On this occasion, the godfather was William Smith, a haberdasher and neighbour in Henley Street. The name of the infant was given before he was dipped in the font, and the sign of the cross marked upon his forehead. At the font, the gossips were exhorted to make sure that William Shakespeare heard sermons and learned the creed, as well as the Lord's Prayer, in the English tongue. After the baptism, a piece of white linen cloth was placed on the head of the child, and remained there until the mother had been churched or purified. It was called the chrism cloth, and, if the infant died within a month, was used as a shroud. The ceremony of the Reformed Anglican faith in the time of Elizabeth still favoured the presentation of apostle spoons or christening shirts to the infant, given by the gossips, and the consumption of a christening cake in celebration. They were, after all, celebrating the saving of young William Shakespeare for eternity. Of his earthly life there was much less certainty. In the 16th century, the mortality of the newly born was high. 9% died within a week of birth, and a further 11% before they were a month old. In the decade of Shakespeare's own birth, there were in Stratford 62.8 average annual baptisms and 42.8 average annual child burials. You had to be tough, or from a relatively prosperous family, to survive the odds. It is likely that Shakespeare had both of these advantages. Once the dangers of childhood had been surmounted, there was a further difficulty. The average lifespan of an adult male was 47 years. Since Shakespeare's parents were by this standard long-lived, he may have hoped to emulate their example, but he survived only 6 years beyond the average span. Something had wearied him. Since in London the average life expectancy was only 35 years in the more affluent parishes and 25 years in the poorer areas, it may have been the city that killed him. But this roll call of death had one necessary consequence. Half of the population were under the age of 20. It was a youthful culture, with all the vigour and ambition of early life. London itself was perpetually young. The first test of Shakespeare's own vigour came only 3 months after his birth. In the parish register of the 11th of July 1564, beside the record of the burial of a weaver's young apprentice from the High Street, was written, "Hic incipit pestis." Here begins the plague. In a period of 6 months, some 237 residents of Stratford died, more than a tenth of its population. A family of four expired on the same side of Henley Street as the Shakespeares. But the Shakespeares survived. Perhaps the mother and her newborn son escaped to her old family home in the neighbouring hamlet of Wilmcote, and stayed there until the peril had passed. Only those who remained in the town succumbed to the infection.
We've just heard Shakespeare, the Biography, by Peter Ackroyd.
Social media. It's got everyone buzzing these days. But what is it, really? And how can you put it to work for you? More than just a passing trend that's hot today, gone tomorrow, social media is marketing that is making a difference for savvy business people who have jumped into the future. Magic Buzz is a new online marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media like Facebook and Twitter together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. Magic Buzz's socio-viral solution provides the measurable value of online advertising that works, affordable, and effective. So get the buzz going for your business. Magic Buzz, with only one Z, because we're never asleep. Visit us at magicbuz.com. For more information or any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Eleanor Brown is the New York Times best-selling author of The Weird Sisters, hailed by People magazine as a delightful debut. Eleanor's writing has also appeared in anthologies, journals, magazines, and newspapers. She was born and raised in D.C. Eleanor has now lived in cities across the U.S., in England, and she's back in Colorado. Welcome, Eleanor. Thanks so much for stopping by the Book Report today.
Oh, I'm so excited to be here. Thank you.
All right, let's start with the obvious first question. Why the title The Weird Sisters?
Well, The Weird Sisters has kind of a double meaning. The first one is that it's a story about a family, and who doesn't have a family that's a little bit weird? But then the other meaning is that it's a reference to the three witches in Macbeth who call themselves the Weird Sisters. And they're actually the Fates. And the book is concerned somewhat with, do you have a fate? Is there a path in life that we are supposed to follow? Or do we get to make our own decisions? So it's got kind of those two layers to it.
All right. So the book is about three sisters, each with Shakespearean names, Rosalind, Rose, Bianca, Bean, and Cordelia, Cordy. I believe I read that you come from a family of three sisters. Is that right? All right. So which sister are you in the book?
Well, technically, I guess I should be the youngest, Cordelia, but I like to think of myself as a little bit of all of them. I wrote the book to try to figure out some issues that I was going through, and so I put some of the questions that I was trying to answer in each one of the characters, and I hope when people read it, they'll find themselves sympathizing a little bit with each one of the sisters.
All right. The father in the novel is a renowned Shakespearean professor, and there's Shakespeare verse woven all through the book. How did you come to center your book around the bard?
It was kind of an accident, really. What I wanted to deal with is the way that families develop their own languages, the way that if you go into someone else's house, you know, they're using nicknames you don't understand and phrases and quotes. And Shakespeare just kind of was my way of approaching that, of creating a language for this family. And of course, Shakespeare's wonderful because he's kind of invaded our culture. So even if you'd never read Macbeth, if I said to you, double, double, toil and trouble, you would probably guess somehow that came from Shakespeare.
Well, there are so many Shakespearean quotes throughout the book. How hard did you have to research Shakespeare to find just the right one for all the spaces in the writing?
Really hard. I did a lot of reading and a lot of researching before I was writing and while I was writing. I'm not a Shakespearean expert. I'm just a fan. And so it was great fun. But this is a family whose knowledge of Shakespeare is much broader than any of ours. And so they're not going to quote the obvious quotes. So I had to really dig and find things. And they take them all completely out of context, I should say. So you don't have to have a deep knowledge of Shakespeare to understand what's going on in the book.
You know, I'm wondering, the father quoted a lot of Shakespeare, and that was a lot of the times the way he dealt with his daughters. Was that a way to keep them distant, or did you write him to be a bit distant, or that was just how he could communicate?
I think that it's a little bit of both. I think the father is really uncomfortable with his emotions, and so instead of coming up with his own words, he just quotes Shakespeare because it's much easier for him to use somebody else's words. But the daughters are really frustrated by that because they're at a point in their lives where they're sort of trying to become more genuine and trying to become more adult, and they would really like it if they could just all communicate in their own words. But again, that was just my way of getting at the way that different families communicate. Mm. And some people really have problems expressing their emotions.
You know, in the book, the mother and father had such a wonderful love story. The home seemed like a really loving home, yet each of the sisters was kind of flawed in very distinct ways, but it made me feel like a little bit sad because their home was so loving. Talk about that.
Yeah, so one of the things that the sisters wrestle with in the book is that their parents are so deeply in love with each other, maybe almost to the point of excluding the daughters from that love because that relationship is so important to them. And in the book, the mother is also wrestling with a serious illness. So I think that marriage is the most important thing. But one of the things that I was trying to get at is the way that our choices really influence the situations we find ourselves in. And sometimes we make really bad choices and do really stupid things, and it's nobody's fault but our own. So I didn't want to have them growing up in sort of a miserable childhood and be able to blame everything on that. I wanted them to do the things that we all do, to make silly choices and end up in bad situations and then have to find their way back out of that again.
Towards the end of the story, the town minister tells the middle sister, Bianca, to stop defining herself in terms of her sisters, to live her own story. Do you think it's possible for someone to be really free from comparison to their sibs and to be a totally separate person?
I'd like to think so. I don't think so. But what I do think that we can do is change the way we think. Family patterns are really persistent. And one of the reasons that I wrote the book was I was trying to figure out why, even though I was a fully fledged adult, whenever I would be around my sisters or my parents, I kind of slipped back into that youngest child role. I became the baby again. So it was important to me to break that pattern. And that's kind of why he says that, because while I will never be able to break free of that role entirely unless everybody in my family changed, I can change the way I think about it, and I can make the decision not to compare myself to my sister. So even though other people might continue to do that, I don't have to do that.
All right. Well, you know, you wrote the book in first person plural, narrated from the collective perspective of the three sisters. What made you choose this form?
You know, it just felt so natural to me when I started writing it. I almost didn't really think about it. Because if you think about the way that we tell stories about our families, we often use that we. Like when we were little, we went to Disney World. Or even in a marriage, we like to go out to dinner on Friday night. And it kind of becomes this separate person in the story. And so having the three sisters narrate together really allows them to comment on each other's actions in the way that people in a family would.
All right. Well, are you already at work on something new?
I am working on something new.
You want to share?
Well, I am the youngest child, so planning is not my strong suit. So I always hesitate a little bit because I don't know if what I'm working on now is how it's going to turn out. But what I'm working on right now is another story set in a small town in the summer. But the hook of this one is that over the course of the summer, all the characters get exactly what they have always wanted.
Ooh. Tempting but dangerous.
Yes, exactly.
Well, Eleanor, I truly enjoyed the book. It's a fast read, and it's really a great story. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
All right, bye.
Bye.
And now let's hear a bit of The Weird Sisters.
Cordy had never stolen anything before. As a matter of pride, when our friends were practicing their light-fingered shuffles across the shelves of Barnwell's stores in our teens, she had refused to participate, refused even to wear the cheap earrings and clumpy lipstick or listen to the shoplifted music. But here she was in this no-name desert town, facing off against the wall of pregnancy tests, knowing full well she didn't have the money to pay for one. A Wild West shootout. Cordy versus the little pink sticks at high noon. She'd wanted to do this somewhere anonymous, in a wide-aisled store that hummed with soft, inoffensive music and belonged to a company, not a person. But those stores had long ago gotten smart, put anti-theft devices like hunch-shouldered guardians at the doors. So she was in this dusty little mom-and-pop drugstore, her stomach churning, cheeks bright with fire. "Strike up the drum, cry courage and away," she whispered to herself, and then giggled, one thin hand sneaking out to grab one of the boxes. Anyone, it didn't matter. They'd all tell her the things she already knew but refused to admit. She slipped the box into her gaping shoulder bag with one hand, the other rooting around at the bottom for the remnants of her last months-ago paycheck, the few loose coins buried in a grave of stale breath mints, lint, and broken pens. Along the way, she grabbed a toffee bar off the shelf and presented it to the cashier, digging for a few more pennies, her hand burning when she brushed against the box hidden in the loose depths. Outside the store, a rush of elation. "Too easy," she said aloud to the empty street, her skirt whispering against the sidewalk, already gone hot and sullen in the rise of spring, her sandals so worn that she could feel the insistent warmth against her heels. The pleasure of the forbidden lasted until she had made it back to the house, ramshackle and dark, where she was staying. A few people crashed on the broken furniture in the living room, sleeping off last night's excess. She yanked open the box, tossing the instructions in the direction of the trash can, and did the deed. Huddled on the toilet in the bathroom, tile cracked and shredding beneath her feet, staring at the pink line, pale as fading newsprint, her conscience caught up with her. "It doesn't get much lower than this, old Cordy old sock," she could hear Bean telling her cheerfully. "How are you going to take care of a baby if you can't even afford a pregnancy test?" Rose harped. Cordy brushed our imaginary voices aside and buried the evidence in the trash can. It didn't make a difference, really, she told herself. She'd been headed home anyway, wandering a circuitous loop, going where the wind or the next ride took her. This just confirmed what she'd already known, that after 7 years of floating like a dandelion seed, it was time to settle down. Settle down? She shuddered. Those words were a bell ringing inside her. That was, after all, why she'd left. Just before exams in the spring of her junior year at Barnwell College, she'd been in the study lounge in the psychology department, lying on the industrial carpet, her arms locked as she held a textbook above her face. Two women, seniors, were talking nearby. One of them was getting married, the other going to graduate school. Cordy lowered the book to her chest, its weight pressing harder and harder against her heart as she listened to the litany of what was to come. Wedding favors and student loans, mortgages and health insurance, careers and taxes. Unable to breathe, she shoved the book onto the floor and walked out of the lounge. If that was the future, she wanted no part of it.
That was The Weird Sisters by Eleanor Brown. For
For nearly two centuries, the authorship of William Shakespeare's plays has been challenged by writers and artists as diverse as Sigmund Freud, Mark Twain, Henry James, Helen Keller, Orson Welles, and Malcolm X. How could a young man from Stratford, lacking a university education, write some of the greatest works in the English language? How do we explain the seemingly unbridgeable gap between Shakespeare's life and his works? Contested Will, Who Wrote Shakespeare, by James Shapiro, seems to unravel the mystery of Shakespeare's authorship, retracing why and when doubts first arose, and why, in the end, there can be no doubt about who wrote the plays. Much ado about nothing? Let's listen as Wanda McCadden narrates.
During the time I've been working on this book, four more names have been put forward. The poet and courtier Fulk Greville, the Irish rebel William Nugent, the poet Amelia Lanier, of Jewish descent and thought by some to be the unnamed Dark Lady of the Sonnets, and Elizabethan diplomat Henry Neville. New candidates will almost surely be proposed in years to come. While the chapters that follow focus on Francis Bacon and the Earl of Oxford, whose candidacies are the best documented and most consequential, it's not because I believe that their claims are necessarily stronger than any of these others. An exhaustive account of all the candidates, including those already advanced and those waiting in the wings, would be both tedious and futile, and for reasons that will soon become clear, Bacon and Oxford can be taken as representative. Much of what has been written about the authorship of Shakespeare's plays follows the contours of a detective story, which is not all that surprising, since the authorship question and the whodunit emerged at the same historical moment. Like all good detective fiction, the Shakespeare mystery can be solved only by determining what evidence is credible, retracing steps, and avoiding false leads. My own account in the pages that follow is no different. I've spent the past 25 years researching and teaching Shakespeare's works at Columbia University. For some, that automatically disqualifies me from writing fairly about the controversy on the grounds that my professional investments are so great that I cannot be objective. There are a few who have gone so far as to hint at a conspiracy at work among Shakespeare professors and institutions, with scholars paid off to suppress information that would undermine Shakespeare's claim. If so, somebody forgot to put my name on the list. My graduate school experience taught me to be sceptical of unexamined historical claims, even ones that other Shakespeareans took on faith. I'd wanted to write my doctoral dissertation on Shakespeare and the Jews, but was told that since there were no Jews in Shakespeare's England, there were no Jewish questions, and I should turn my attention elsewhere. I reluctantly did so, but years later, after a good deal of research, I learned that both claims were false. There was, in fact, a small community of Jews living in Elizabethan London, and many leading English writers at that time wrestled in their work with questions of Jewish difference in an effort to get a better grasp of what constituted English identity. That experience, and the book that grew out of it, taught me the value of revisiting truths universally acknowledged. There yet remains one subject walled off from serious study by Shakespeare scholarship, the authorship question. More than one fellow Shakespearean was disheartened to learn that I was committing my energies to it, as if somehow I was wasting my time and talent, or worse, at risk of going over to the dark side. I became increasingly interested in why this subject remains virtually taboo in academic circles, as well as in the consequences of this collective silence. One thing is certain, the decision by professors to all but ignore the authorship question hasn't made it disappear. If anything, more people are drawn to it than ever. And because prominent Shakespeareans, with the notable exceptions of Samuel Schoenbaum, Jonathan Bate, Marjorie Garber, Gary Taylor, Stanley Wells, and Alan Nelson, have all but surrendered the field, general readers curious about the subject typically learn about it through the books and websites of those convinced that Shakespeare could never have written the plays. This was forcefully brought home not long ago when I met with a group of 9-year-olds at a local elementary school to talk about Shakespeare's poetry. When, toward the end of the class, I invited questions, a quiet boy on my left raised his hand and said, "My brother told me that Shakespeare really didn't write Romeo and Juliet. Is that true?" It was the kind of question I was used to hearing from undergraduates on the first day of a Shakespeare course, or from audience members at popular lectures. But I hadn't expected the doubts about Shakespeare's authorship had filtered down to the fourth grade. Not long after, at the Bank Street bookstore, the best children's bookstore in New York City, I ran into a colleague from the history department buying a stack of books for her 12-year-old daughter.
That was Contested Will by James Shapiro. Becoming Shakespeare by Jack Lynch begins with his death in 1616 and relates the fascinating story of the unlikely transformation from provincial playwright to universal bard. Unlike later literary giants, Shakespeare created no stir when he died. Though he'd had a string of hit plays, he'd been retired in the country for 6 years, and only his family, friends, and business partners seemed to care that he was gone. Within a few years, he was nearly forgotten. When London's theaters were shut down in 1642, he seemed destined for oblivion. With the Restoration in 1660, though, the theaters were open once again, and Shakespeare began his long ascent. No longer merely one playwright among many, he became the transcendent genius at the heart of English culture. 50 years after the Restoration, scholars began taking him seriously. 50 years after that, he was considered England's greatest genius. And by 1800, he was practically divine. Lynch vividly chronicles the revival of Shakespeare's plays to the bardolatry of the Stratford celebration of Shakespeare's 300th birthday in 1864. Becoming Shakespeare is not only essential reading for anyone intrigued by the bard, but it also offers a consideration of the vagaries of fame. The work is performed by James Adams.
On Thursday, 25 April 1616, William Shakespeare's mortal remains were laid to rest. It was a bright, warm spring afternoon in Stratford-upon-Avon. A few high clouds provided an ironically cheerful counterpoint to the melancholy mood below. Inside the Church of the Holy Trinity, crowded around a fresh grave, stood the playwright's many admirers, who had been following his career in London since he first arrived on the theatrical scene a quarter century earlier. Some in the back jockeyed for position to see what was going on. Closer to the front were some of the most distinguished theatrical men of the day, the actor Richard Burbage, the playwrights Philip Massinger and Thomas Hayward, and Shakespeare's partners in the King's Men Theatre Company, John Hemmings and Henry Condell. By far the most important guest was Henry Wriothesley, 3rd Earl of Southampton, Shakespeare's friend and patron from the beginning of his career. The mourners took turns reading passages from his poems and plays, their voices quivering with emotion. Ben Jonson even contributed a poem of his own to mark the sad occasion. Or maybe not. Maybe it was a cold, dark morning. Shakespeare had died suddenly, and few of his London friends had received the news that his end was imminent. Even fewer were able to make the trip to Stratford. The spring rains had washed out many of the roads from the capital. Only his local friends, including a few who had known him since childhood, made it to the service. The centre of attention was Anne Shakespeare, née Hathaway, her eyes red as she wept over her husband's casket and received comforting embraces from their daughters, Susanna and Judith. Or maybe it was an uncommonly warm late April day, with a few mourners standing uncomfortably in the hot church, their eyes nervously scanning the entrance. The number of mourners was deliberately kept small because the priest reading the burial service was a crypto-Catholic. It was not long since England had officially embraced Protestantism, and Roman Catholicism was regarded as a serious threat to the nation. Many Catholics had been executed for their plots against Queen Elizabeth, and Shakespeare, a secret Catholic himself, had been a friend to many of them. In his final days, he called on the local Catholic priest to read the last rites, and now he was being interred in secret in the old religion. Or, once again, maybe not. The fact is, no one knows what William Shakespeare's funeral was like. Church records show that he died on 23rd April 1616 and was buried 2 days later. After a very successful career as an actor, playwright and theatrical shareholder in London, he had retired to the town of his birth, Stratford-upon-Avon. He had been living there with his wife and two daughters, probably since 1610 or 1611. But the cause of his death is a mystery. No record of who attended the funeral survives. No one knows what sympathies he might have had for Catholicism. This hasn't stopped people from speculating about all of these matters, but hard facts are frustratingly few. As the critic Paul Fussell writes, with only slight exaggeration, what we actually know about Shakespeare as a person can go on a 3x5 card without crowding. But the writings, confidently telling his life story and delineating his personality, morals, temper, and character, would fill moving vans.
That was Becoming Shakespeare by Jack Lynch. Ralph Fiennes recently released his innovative film version of Coriolanus, Shakespeare's tragedy believed to have been written between 1605 and 1608. The play is based on the life of the legendary Roman leader Gaius Marcius Coriolanus. Whether you've seen the movie yet or not, I thought you'd enjoy this classic performance by Richard Burton, Jessica Tandy, and a full cast.
I shall tell you a pretty tale. It may be you have heard it, but since it serves my purpose, I'll venture to tale it a little more.
Well, I'll hear it, sir. Yet you must not think to fob off our disgrace with a tale, but I'm pleased to deliver.
There was a time when all the body's members rebelled against the belly, thus accused it, that only like a gulf it did remain in the midst of the body, idle and unactive, still coveting the viand, never bearing like labor with the rest, where the other instruments did see, and hear, devise, instruct, walk, feel, and mutually participate, did minister unto the appetite and affection common of the whole body. The belly answered.
Well, sir, what answer made the belly?
Sir, I shall tell you. With a kind of smile, which ne'er came from the lungs, but even thus, for look you, I may make the belly smile as well as speak. It tauntingly replied to the discontented members, the mutinous parts that envied his receipt, even so most fitly as you malign our senators, for that they are not such as you.
Your belly's answer! What? The kingly crowned head, the vigilant eye, the counselor heart, the armor soldier, our steed, the leg, the tongue, our trumpeter, with other muniments and petty helps in this our fabric, if that they...
What then? For me this fellow speaks. What then? What then?
Should by the cormorant belly be restrained, who is the sink of the body?
Well, what then?
The former agents, if they did complain, what could the belly answer?
I will tell you. If you'll bestow a small of what you have little patience about. Just hear the belly's answer.
You're long about it.
Note me this, good friend. Your most grave belly was deliberate, not rash, like his accusers. And thus answered. True is it, my incorporate friends, quoth he, that I receive the general food at first, which you do live upon. And fit it is, because I am the storehouse and the shop of the whole body. But if you do remember, I send it through the rivers of your blood, even to the court, the heart, to the seat of the brain, and through the cranks and offices of man, the strongest nerves and small inferior veins from me receive that natural competency whereby they live. And though that all at once you, my good friends, this saith the belly, mark me.
Aye, sir. Well, well.
Though all at once cannot see what I do deliver out to each, yet I can make my audit up that all from me do back receive the flower of all and leave me but the brand. What say you, dude?
It was an answer. How apply you this?
The senators of Rome are this good belly, and you the mutinous members. For examine, their counsels and their cares digest things rightly, touching the weal of the common. You shall find no public benefit which you receive, but it proceeds or comes from them to you, and no way from yourselves. What do you think, you, the great toe of this assembly?
I, the great toe? Why the great toe?
For that being one of the lowest, basest, poorest of this most wise rebellion, thou goest foremost, thou rascal, that art worst in blood to run, leadst first to win some vantage. But make you ready, your stiff bats and clubs. Rome and her rats are at the point of battle. No one side must have bail. Hail, noble Marcius!
Thanks. What's the matter, you dissentious rogues, that rubbing the poor itch of your opinion make yourselves scabs?
We have ever your good
words! He that will give good words to thee will flatter beneath a boring. What would you have, you curs, that like nor peace nor war? The one affrights you, the other makes you proud. He that trusts to you where he should find you lions, find you hares, where foxes geese. You are no surer know than is the coal of fire upon the ice, or hailstone in the sun. Your virtue is to make him worthy whose offense subdues him, and curse that justice did it. Who deserves greatness deserves your hate, and your affections are a sick man's appetite, who desires most that which would increase his evil. He that depends upon your favors swims with fins of lead and hews down oaks with rushes. Trust ye, hang ye. But every minute you do change your mind and call him noble, that was now your hate. Him vile, that was your garland. What's the matter that in these several places of the city you cry against the noble senate who, under the gods, keep you in awe, which else would feed on one another?
That was Coriolanus. G.J. Meyer presents a fresh look at the fabled dynasty in The Tudors. In 1485, young Henry Tudor, whose claim to the throne was appallingly weak, crossed the English Channel from France at the head of a ragtag little army and took the crown from the family that had ruled England for almost 400 years. Half a century later, his son, Henry VIII, desperate to rid himself of his first wife in order to marry a second, launched a reign of terror aimed at taking powers no previous monarch had ever dreamed of. In the process, he plunged his kingdom into generations of division and disorder, creating a legacy of blood and betrayal that would blight the lives of his children and the destiny of his country. The boy king, Edward VI, a fervent believer in reforming the English church, died before he could bring to fruition his dream of a second English Reformation. Mary I, the disgraced daughter of Catherine of Aragon, tried and failed to reestablish the Catholic Church and produce an heir. And finally came Elizabeth I, who devoted her life to creating an image of herself as Gloriana the Virgin Queen, but, behind that mask, sacrificed all chance of personal happiness in order to survive. Robin Sachs narrates.
It needed to make the mass of English men and women see the Tudor century as the supreme forward leap in England's history, a sweeping away of the dark legacy of the Middle Ages. This whole Whig view of history requires a smug certainty that the medieval world was a cesspit of superstition and repression. It demanded agreement that the Tudors had put England on the high road to greatness, and that to say otherwise was to be not only extravagantly foolish or dishonest, but actually unfit for participation in public life. Centuries of relentless indoctrination and denial ensued, with the result that England turned into a rather curious phenomenon, a great nation actively contemptuous of much of its own history. One still sees the evidence almost whenever British television attempts to deal with pre-Tudor and Tudor history. It was not until the second half of the 20th century, really, that historians of some eminence in England and the United States began, often slowly and grudgingly, to acknowledge that the established view of the Tudor era was essentially mythological and could never be reconciled with a dispassionate examination of the facts. Not until even more recently was the old propaganda pretty much abandoned as indefensible. Tudor history remains controversial because, quite extraordinarily for a subject now half a millennium old, its meaning is still being settled. The truth is still being cleared of centuries of systematic denial. With the Academy still bringing 16th century England into focus, we should not be surprised that much of the reading public and virtually the entire entertainment industry remain in the thrall of Tudors who never existed. Whether this will ever change, whether the cartoon versions of Henry VIII and Elizabeth I that now shine in the celebrity heavens alongside James Dean and the Incredible Hulk will ever give way to something with a better connection to reality is anybody's guess. Perhaps such a change is no longer possible. It is certainly not going to happen as a consequence of this book. I do entertain the more modest hope, however, that a single volume aimed at introducing the entire dynasty to a general readership might prove useful in two ways. By helping to show that the true story of the Tudors is much richer and more fascinating than the fantasy version, and by showing also that the whole story is vastly greater than the sum of its parts. That it contains depths and dimensions that cannot be brought to light by focusing exclusively on Henry VIII, Elizabeth I, or any other single member of the family. That if it is as deeply tragic as I believe it to be, as I hope I have shown it to be, the extent of the tragedy can become clear only when the five reigns are joined together in a narrative arc that begins with Henry VII building a great legacy out of almost nothing, moves on to his son's extravagant abuse of a magnificent inheritance, and follows the son's three children as, one after another, and in their joltingly different ways, they attempt to cope with what their father had wrought. If a writer should have an excuse for adding to the endless stream of Tudor literature, I therefore offer these. That not enough has been done to deal with the Tudor dynasty as a continuum, a unity, and that popular perceptions of the family have fallen so far behind scholarly understanding that it is necessary to try, at least, to narrow the gap. I disavow any claim to competing with, never mind replacing, the many splendid biographies of the Tudor monarchs and their spouses, agents, and victims that have appeared over the last half century or so. To the contrary, I have drawn heavily on many such works in assembling the facts with which to weave my story, and I am not merely in their debt, but could scarcely have even begun without them. And I am mindful that my approach carries a price. Dealing with five reigns obviously makes it impossible to provide the depth of detail available in, to cite just one distinguished example, J.J. Scarisbrick's magisterial Henry VIII. But it seems fair to question whether so much detail is necessary or even desirable in a work aimed at a general readership, and in any case, foregoing it brings a gain too.
That was The Tudors by G.J. Meyer. And speaking of The Tudors, in The Lady in the Tower, The Fall of Anne Boleyn, New York Times bestselling author Alison Weir recounts the last days of Henry VIII's second wife. Accused of adultery, incest, and treason, Anne is locked in the Tower of London on May 2, 1536. Despite maintaining her innocence, she's quickly condemned to death. Soon, one sword stroke sends her to eternity. But as her remains rot in the sun, unblessed by coffin, marker, or funeral, few know the truth behind her swift demise. Judith Boyd narrates.
In the late 17th century, Gilbert Burnet, Bishop of Salisbury, who painstakingly researched Anne Boleyn's fall in order to refute the claims of Sander, would conclude that the handkerchief incident never happened, since this circumstance is not spoken of by Sir John Spelman, a judge of that time, who wrote an account of the whole transaction with his own hand in his commonplace book. Halfway through the jousts, a message was passed to Henry VIII, and suddenly, to everyone's astonishment, especially the Queen's, the King departed to Westminster, having not above six persons with him, leaving Anne to preside alone over what remained of the tournament. Of which sudden departing many men mused, but most chiefly the Queen. She must have felt bewildered and fearful at the very least, because for some days now the King had been distant or simmering with rage, and she had very good reasons to suspect that something ominous had happened, and that it concerned herself. She was the Queen of England, and she should have been in an invincible position. yet she was painfully aware that she had failed Henry in the most important thing that mattered. She could not but have realized that his long-cherished passion for her had died, and that his amorous interest now had another focus. But she clearly also knew that there was more to this present situation than mere infidelity. For months now, the court had been abuzz with speculation that the king might take another wife. But that was not all. A week before the tournament, Anne's brother, one of the most powerful men at court, had been publicly slighted. That could have been explained in a number of ways, but many saw it as a slur upon herself. Since then, her father, a member of the King's Council and privy to state secrets, who could have told her much that would frighten her, may have said something that gave her cause for alarm. She had perhaps guessed that members of her household were being covertly and systematically questioned. How she found out is a matter for speculation, but there can be no doubt that she knew something was going on. Just 4 days earlier, she had sought out her chaplain and begged him to look to the care of her daughter should anything happen to her, the Queen. Plainly, she was aware of some undefined impending danger. She knew, too, that only yesterday her tongue, never very guarded, had run away with her, and that she had spoken rashly, even treasonously, overstepping the conventional bounds of courtly banter between queen and servant, man and woman, and also that her words had been overheard. She was fretting about that, and had gone so far as to take steps to protect her good name. But it was too late. Others were putting their own construction on what she had said, and it was damning. Anne perhaps feared that the king had been told of her compromising words. On the day, or morning, before the tournament, she had made a dramatic emotional appeal to him, only to be angrily rebuffed. Then had come the startling announcement, late the previous evening, that a planned and important royal journey had been postponed. The signs had not been good, but the exact nature of the forces that menaced Anne was almost certainly a mystery to her. So she surely could not have predicted, when the king got up and walked out of the royal stand on that portentous May Day, that that was the last time she would ever set eyes on him, and that she herself and those gallant contestants in the jousts were about to be annihilated in one of the most astonishing and brutal coups in English history.
That was The Lady in the Tower by Alison Weir. John O'Farrell presents British history in such a way that you'll have a good laugh while learning all the stuff you feel you really ought to know by now. In an utterly impartial history of Britain, you'll learn how Anglo-Saxon liberals struggled to be, shall we say, positive about immigration. Discover how England's peculiar class system was established by snobby French nobles whose posh descendants still have wine cellars. And explore the complex reason why the Stuart kings were the first in Europe to be brought to heel, which could have been because they were such a useless bunch of untalented, incompetent, arrogant, upper-class monarchs that Parliament didn't have much choice. British history with Tude? You betcha. Listen as the author narrates.
It's just that it strikes me as odd that while we seem to have total contempt for today's politicians, a syphilitic wife murderer like Henry VIII gets voted onto the BBC's lists of all-time Great Britons. He came in at number 40, greater than Charles Dickens, but apparently less great than Michael Crawford. Though, to be fair, Henry VIII's Frank Spencer impression was rubbish. When I said I wanted to write a humorous history of Britain, a common reaction was, what, like 1066 and all that? But unlike that comic classic, this is not a subversion of what we already know. This presumes that we never knew it in the first place. It assumes that when our history teacher slunk off to the staff room for another ciggy, mumbling the inspiring guidance, take notes from chapter 7, we did nothing of the sort, choosing instead to put to the test the bold claim printed on Timothy Johnson's shatterproof ruler. I hope this book will provide the chance to put all that right by going right back to basics and assuming the reader has only the sketchiest knowledge of the story of Britain. Britain, you know, big island off the coast of Europe, rains a lot. My aim has been to write a funny, accessible history of Britain for all those people who weren't listening at school. And I've been amazed how many people said, "That's exactly the book I need to read." In fact, I'm still struggling to find a single person who was listening at school. This is a shame, because unless you have the bad luck to be studying The Whig Oligarchy, 1714 to 1763, the history of Britain really is a fascinating and compelling story, packed with one great character after another, trapped inside impossible dilemmas and gripping adventures, which will have you thinking, "I wonder if he dies at the end." Obviously, he always does die at the end. It happened hundreds of years ago. The ending up dead bit is something of a foregone conclusion. The 2,000 years in the subtitle takes us from 55 BC to 1945. Clearly, no history book can be comprehensive. Edward Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire took him 15 years to write and was published in 6 fat volumes, totalling 1.5 million words. And then to wind him up, all his mates said, "I can't believe you left out the Siege of Ravenna, Eddie." "What Siege of Ravenna?" "God, that's crucial, that is, Ed. No, Siege of Ravenna. That's central to the whole decline and fall thing, man." It's not possible to cover everything, and I apologise now to Scottish and Welsh readers for the way that English history tends to dominate these pages, in much the same way that England has trodden all over her creative and enterprising neighbours. But all that stuff that you vaguely heard about but never quite understood, all those niggling questions that seem too obvious to ask, I will attempt to explain all of it here, trying to unpick the causes and the consequences before giving up and saying, "Oh, well, look, you had to be there, really." Chapter 1. Ancient and Roman Britain. How the Romans established our template for civilization by killing anyone who didn't like it. There must have been a single day on which it happened. A definite moment 7,000 years ago, when the strip of land connecting us to continental Europe disappeared under the waves to create a new island of Britain. Was there a last-minute rush to get across as people saw what was happening? An anxious wife trying to hurry her husband out of the prehistoric departure lounge as that last rising tide lapped at the disappearing causeway. "This is the last call for anyone wishing to cross the land bridge to Britain. Last call for Indigenous Britons. Please proceed to Gate 1. "Come on, we're going to miss it." "Stop fussing, dear. We've got loads of time." Or did the isthmus just become increasingly treacherous over the decades, so that larger animals such as elks, bisons and humans could wade through the increasingly boggy salt marshes, leaving all the hedgehogs and badgers sulking at the water's edge? At low tide, it's still possible to stand on the Goodwin Sands in the middle of the English Channel, though you might not want to pay the bloke with a boat until he's come back to pick you up again. However it happened, 5,000 years BC is apparently incredibly recent in terms of the entire history of mankind. You have to ask what sort of timescale these historians and geologists are working to, because I can't help feeling that 5,000 BC was ages ago. Last Tuesday was recent. Windows XP, that was quite recent. This extreme period of climate change must surely have been a catastrophe for those who lived through it. Thousands of square miles of inhabitable land were suddenly claimed by the sea, a vast area now underneath the North Sea, containing the villages and hunting grounds of long-forgotten societies, disappeared under the waves.
That was An Utterly Impartial History of Britain by John O'Farrell. Well, all's well that ends well. I hope you've enjoyed today's show. I know you are all quite the literary crowd. And, lest I forget, a shout out to some of my very special listeners. There's a new ranking out of the most literary cities in the country, which are, drumroll please, number 1, Washington, D.C., 2, Seattle, 3, Minneapolis, 4, Atlanta, 5, Boston, 6, Pittsburgh, 7, Cincinnati, 8, St. Louis, 9, San Francisco, and 10, Denver. The ranking is based on number of bookstores, library resources, newspaper circulation, and internet resources. So, kudos to my listeners in WMAL Washington, WAFS in Atlanta, and WNBP in Boston. Nicely done. The rest of you,
get reading. See you back here next week on The Book Report.